Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening this morning. In the first part of the program, we'll be talking a bit about the defense needs of the country, U.S. defense policy, how it is that we're thinking about what kind of military we need and how to get there. And our guest for the program today is Lieutenant Colonel Robert Harvey. He's a National Defense Fellow at the University of Illinois here in Urbana in the Program for Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. As a visiting scholar, he gives lectures and takes part in seminars and discussions concerning international security issues, among other things. He's a command pilot with more than 4,000 flying hours. He holds a master's degree in aeronautical science. He's a graduate of the Air Force Squadron Officer School and the Marine Corps Command and Staff College. His most recent assignment was as commander of an F-16 fighter squadron at Shaw Air Force Base in South Carolina. His assignments have also included tours at Hill Air Force Base in Utah, at a couple of bases in Germany. He flew in the Persian Gulf War. He flew 22 combat missions and received the Distinguished Flying Cross for his service. And we're glad he could be here with us and spend a little bit of time talking about these topics here this morning. And as we talk, questions, of course, are welcome. All we ask, though, is that for people calling in that they try to keep their questions brief, just so we can keep things moving along and try to get everybody in. But, of course, anybody's welcome to call. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, so that means if it would be long-distance call for you, you may use that number. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thank you very much.
Good morning, David. Thank you for having me.
Almost as soon as the Cold War ended, or we thought the Cold War was ended, people in the Pentagon and in defense circles started to raise this question, what kind of defense are we going to need now that it seems we're in a new era?
Exactly. At the end of the Cold War in 1992, the Pentagon conducted what was called a bottom-up review, and later in 1997, a quadrennial defense review, which they're undergoing right now, the second quadrennial defense review. And all of these are designed to shape the military, or to give it their best guess anyway, as to what size military and what capabilities are required for the future. In 1992, I don't think at the time anyone really foresaw that we would be so deeply involved in contingency operations or operations other than warfare. We typically in the military have been given one task excuse me, throughout our history, and that's been basically to win the nation's wars. Post-Cold War environment involved contingency operations ranging from humanitarian assistance around the world to interventions such as Bosnia and Kosovo. At the time, the end of the Cold War, it was widely accepted that we could afford to draw down our force structure and didn't have much fear of fighting a major war. So at that time, we began a drawdown of our forces. And in the Air Force in particular, we've reduced our structure by 40% since the end of the Cold War. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, we've been tasked, or our overseas contingency taskings have increased over 400% in the same time frame. Now, that includes, like I said, situations such as Bosnia and Kosovo, but also operations Southern Watch and Northern Watch, where we still enforce the UN no-fly zones over Iraq.
After the Cold War, as people were talking about, you know, what's the threat going to be in the future, it seems that there was this feeling that the United States needed to be able to fight two major land wars at the same time, and the target adversaries always seemed to be Iraq and North Korea. And as I understand it, a couple of people who were very important in developing that sort of policy or that sort of scenario were indeed Colin Powell and Dick Cheney during the first Bush administration. Now
that's correct, yes.
they're serving in the second Bush administration, and at the time, I think that some people, some defense analysts, looked at that scenario and said, that seems not terribly likely to us that we actually would be doing that. And now it seems that also that the administration perhaps is getting ready to say, well, yes, I guess we think that it's not that likely, that and are starting to talk about moving away from the two-war scenario. Do you think that is indeed
right?
The case?
I would think that's true. That's called the two major regional contingency scenario, the two MRC scenario. At the end of the Cold War, of course, we had just fought the war in Iraq, and there's a potential there that that flare up again at any time. And, of course, we're still deployed to South Korea in defense of South Korea from the Korean War in the 50s. Mm-hmm. Both of those cases at the time seemed the most likely flare-up areas around the world. Of course, we had no inclination whatsoever that we'd ever fight a war with Russia or a major war in Europe again. So in an attempt to base our force structure, to determine the size, the proper size of our force structure, we looked at the two most likely scenarios that would happen. Initially in 1992, the thought process was that if Saddam Hussein, worst case being if Saddam Hussein started a war again and we were fighting a war there, then the North Koreans could act up at the same time, putting the most stress on our forces simultaneously. So that's why the two MRC simultaneous type environment developed out of the Pentagon. Subsequent to that, though, in the QDR of 1997, they decided that we could reduce our force structure a little bit further by adapting a situation or a scenario, let's say, that both of those wars probably wouldn't start at the same time. It's plausible that one government or the other could act up first, and then the other one, seeing how stressed the United States forces were, then could act up. So we went to a near simultaneous two major regional contingency planning situation. Yes, I think today the review in the Pentagon is taking a really hard look at whether or not we need force structure capable of fighting two wars at the same time or nearly simultaneously. They're looking at something called a delaying action in one while they can complete the war in the other, very similar to the World War II scenario where we put our emphasis on Europe first and then fought the war in the Pacific later. Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm interested in how people, particularly in the various service branches, think about this. It's sort of my understanding that if we're saying that we don't think that we're going to be fighting a major land war like the one that we're preparing to fight against the Soviets, and that maybe even the nature, if we have a major conflict on the ground, it's not going to be like World War II. That is, we're going to be relying very heavily on standoff precision bombing, things that the Navy and the Air Force, I mean, they particularly would be involved in. And it's not going to be so much a matter of a lot of tanks on the ground that we're going to have to, if that's the kind of thing that we think we're going to be doing, there's also going to have to be restructuring, and that guys in the Army aren't real happy to hear that news, but guys in the Air Force, yeah, they're pretty happy to hear that news because that means, well, we're saying, well, air power is going to be really, really important, and that that the ground troops, foot soldiers, and armor is just not – yes, we're going to have them. We're going to have soldiers. We're going to have tanks. But that leg of this is just not going to be quite as important as we thought it was back at the time, particularly when we thought maybe we're going to have to defend Europe against an attack from the Soviet Union.
That's exactly true. In today's environment, the weapon of choice has become air power as an initial weapon of choice or as an initial – method for controlling a belligerent-type country. Let's say, for example, the no-fly zones or deny flight in Bosnia prior to the war or prior to the peace accords in Bosnia, and now the operations Northern and Southern Watch over Iraq. Those are primarily enforced by air power. But there will be a need for a ground army at some time. Now, when we look at how to size our military, the first thing you got to remember is this is just a guess based on the intelligence mm-hmm. around the world. So if we look at our own history, we were woefully unprepared. At the end of World War II, we had a massive drawdown. We retired everybody and sent them back to civilian life. And less than 5 years later, we were caught totally unprepared in Korea. We're trying to avoid that, or the government is trying to avoid that these days by trying to decide what is the right size of military to maintain in peacetime so that we're not caught that off guard. We do depend heavily on guard and reserve forces, which are obviously not full-time military forces. That's the heritage of our country. From the beginning of days of the Founding Fathers, they wanted us not to have a large standing army, but to depend on the citizen soldiers in times of crisis. That's what we're leaning on today. We're depending more and more every day on the guard and reserve, even for contingency operations. Guard and Reserve pilots, for example, fighter pilots from the Guard and Reserve, Terre Haute, Indiana, Springfield, Illinois, and Fort Wayne, Indiana, often go to Southern Watch and Northern Watch. And now, I believe even some Guard units took part in Kosovo last year, or 99.
One of the figure I came across, and I'm hoping that this is correct, this came out of an op-ed piece that appeared in the Boston Globe last fall, that said that since the Gulf War, the number of military personnel deployed in operations on any given day averaged 40,000. And even if you quadruple that to provide for troop rotation, the total would be less than 12% of the force. Now, I guess some people would look at that and suggest, well, that we have many more people in the military than we actually need. How does anybody actually have a number that says, well, we think that we need so many service people, and then perhaps when you look at, you say, well, we need pilots, we need people to sail ships, we need people to drive tanks. How many in the various branches we need?
Well, that's exactly what the Quadrennial Defense Review is doing, and also I believe Secretary of Defense, the new Secretary of Defense, Mr. Rumsfeld, is conducting his own independent review of the force structure and the capabilities each service should have in the future. So I think from both of those reviews, you'll see not a great increase in size, certainly, maybe not even an increase in the budget, but some different programs that will be pushed versus others. Again, remember that the size of the military, of course, just isn't just the 40,000 that are deployed. I mean, we have force structure inside the United States to support that. You have the training force structure, for example, in order to train those 40,000 people. And remember, some get out every year, some come in every year. So in order to train those, you have an entire infrastructure set back here to train personnel, get them through the pipeline, get them ready to deploy overseas. You have retirements and folks getting out of the service every day, you need to replace them as well. So that's basically a duplication there as well. It's a tough situation to be in to decide what is right. It's as if you were buying insurance for your home. Do I need flood insurance? Well, if I live in a floodplain, I probably need flood insurance. If I don't live in a floodplain, do I want to not ever buy flood insurance? Probably not. Maybe not. But I certainly need fire insurance, theft insurance, those kinds of things. So it's a matter for the country of how much insurance would you like to have. The function of the military is nothing more than a continuation of politics. The United States has been very active around the world, engaging other countries around the world, other governments and other countries around the world, particularly in the last 10 years, through operations other than war. And that puts a severe strain and high demand on the military force structure that was, before the end of the Cold War, not designed to deal with that. Since the end of the Cold War, we've adjusted, of course, and we've done our best, as we usually do, to attempt to fulfill the objectives that we've been given, the goals and the missions that we've been given. Those were not, obviously, blowing things up and destroying things in certain countries, but going into a country with our troops on the ground and engaging the military in cooperative means. In other words, we're supporting the militaries in various countries of the former Soviet bloc. And we help them, show them the way we do business, help them with their command and control, and hopefully they'll begin to do business. And through that sharing and learning, we build mutual trust in each other.
Let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might have tuned in the last little bit here. We're speaking with Lieutenant Colonel Robert Harvey. He's a National Defense Fellow, University of Illinois, in the Program for Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. He is an active duty Air Force officer and command pilot. He's here to give lectures and take part in seminars and discussions about international security issues. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. One thing that I read recently was that as far as the Air Force is concerned, that there was, and I'm not sure how recently this is, in the last couple of years perhaps, that the Air Force was actually looking at a pilot shortage, not so much because within the Air Force, it wasn't that they didn't have qualified pilots, but that there were people who were performing administrative functions, who were working at desks instead of actually flying planes. And so, but the bottom line was that you actually didn't have enough pilots. Is that correct?
True? That's absolutely true, David. We're short pilots. That stems from a couple of different problems. First of all, the airlines are hiring. The airlines can hire every pilot that the military can produce from now for the foreseeable future. That's a significant draw on pilots out of the service. It's a lucrative career. It's a very well-paid career field. Pilots in the military, of course, folks in the military are not paid quite, they're not paid anywhere near what airline pilots make. So that's quite a draw for folks to get out of the service. The other part of that, as I mentioned earlier, was the 400% increase in deployments overseas. Typically, from the period 98 to 2000, an average pilot in a combat unit that was deployed overseas 180 days per year. That's 180 days per year away from your family, your kids. The lifestyle itself is that you move basically about every 3 years anyway. So you're uprooting your family, your kids, etc., taking them somewhere else every 3 years, sometimes overseas, sometimes not. A lot of pilots have decided that that lifestyle, that being deployed that much, is not worth it to them, so they've gotten out, gone to the airlines. But the other issue you brought up about folks being on the staff, yes, we do keep some pilots on the staff. That's our immediate ready reserve. Those pilots can be brought back up to flying status within a month or two and ready to go to combat as soon as possible should we find ourselves in a conflict. The only other procedure for building a pilot, for making a pilot, it takes a couple of years. You got to send him through the pilot training and then training in that individual aircraft. So that provides us a ready reserve. In this shortage that we've had, and we've been experiencing ever since Desert Storm, in the shortage, what we do is, what we have done is we've drawn a lot of those pilots off of the staffs and off of those desk jobs and put them back into cockpits. We've reduced our pilot number on the staff considerably. Nearly almost all of the pilots are back into flying billets now.
We have a caller here. Others, if you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. The number, if you're here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. And that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, 800-222-9455. The caller is in Chicago, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Yes,
good
morning.
It's a pleasure to have you on the program. I wondered, as far as I just want to make a comment and then ask a question. As far as Desert Storm is concerned, I think President Reagan planted the seed, so to speak, and President Bush harvested the crop. And that Reagan spent a lot of money on the military, and it was good when you had to use it. You were able to make that buildup and then score an overwhelming victory in Saudi Arabia and Iraq. I just wondered, since we do have a shortage of pilots, should we start depending on advanced technology such as the missile defense system and unmanned piloted drones, you know, to carry the weapons in and that type of thing? What do you think?
Yes, that's exactly what we're doing. But it's not generally because of a shortage of pilots. We would like to use the unmanned combat aerial, what's really uninhabited combat vehicle is what we call it. It's an unmanned aircraft that we're trying to develop to go into the higher threat situations and then release weapons. What we're trying to do there is avoid the loss of pilots, of course, through combat losses. So, yes, we are pursuing other technologies, partly because of the pilot shortage, but mostly because we just don't want to lose pilots in combat.
Well, you know, if we'd had that during the recent situation in China, we would not have had those 24 individuals go through what they did. If we had had an unpiloted surveillance plane go over there, the Chinese may very well have shot it down, but we wouldn't have had these 24 people have to go through that experience of being.
Right, that's true. However, remember that aircraft was in international airspace at the time, and we anticipated no such problems.
Well, that's true. As a matter of fact, I understand that surveillance is so good today that you don't actually have to fly over the enemy territory, that you can be outside the territory and still get what you require to get.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Right, thanks. Well, again, other questions, comments are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We touched on, I think you touched a little bit on the subject of infrastructure. And that is, I guess we should acknowledge that, you know, in the military you do have to have people to fly planes. You've got to have people to sail battleships, and you have to have troops on the ground, infantry and so forth. But for all of those people that are actively engaged in combat, you also have to have a lot of support staff. You have to have the people that train them. You have a lot of people who work on bases just to keep the place going. You got to have mechanics. You have to have medical personnel.
Exactly.
You have to have administrative staff. And there are all kinds of people that you have to do that. But having said that, I think some people are also concerned that maybe the infrastructure, we have more infrastructure than we need. And particularly when you have separate branches of the service, if everybody in a sense has got to have the same infrastructure, then maybe, again, there we have two, we have more people than they actually need. And if we could somehow consolidate that, that we could, so we could take care of the need, we could perform all those functions, and yet perhaps we could do it in a more efficient and more cost-effective sort of way.
That's exactly right. David, we're trying to do that in many instances. And let's go back to the Base Realignment and Closure Commission that was created a few years back, BRAC. It was designed to study the military infrastructure inside the United States and decide which bases we didn't need and we could close. But it's presented to Congress as an all-or-nothing package. You either close all the bases that the commission recommends or you close none of them. Now, excuse me, when you talk about closing bases, you know, you have to go to certain areas. For example, up here at Chanute, you'd have to go to the folks around Rantoul and say, hey, we're going to close your base. That doesn't sit very well with congressmen, senators, and those kinds of folks. Anytime you want to draw down your infrastructure, it has to be approved by Congress. So then you have to wonder, okay, who's willing to give up their base? If we went to St. Louis and said, hey, guys, we want to close Scott Air Force Base, what do you think the folks around St. Louis would say? That's probably not a good option for them. Now, it's been very successful here in the Rantoul area. Folks up there have been able to take Chanute Air Force Base and turn it into something worthwhile, and they've done a great job of it. Also successful down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, where we closed the Air Force Base near the beach. The cities are able to take over the land that the air bases have been sitting on and use it for worthwhile projects. But again, it's something you need to get through Congress, and it's a tough thing to do.
Yeah. We are getting close to the midpoint of the program, and actually there's something we need to do a little test here of our emergency broadcast system, something we do the first Tuesday of every month. So maybe rather than I launching into another question, let's just do that real quick. It'll take about a minute, and then we'll continue our conversation. This is a test of the emergency alert system. And this is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. I guest this morning here in this first hour of Focus 580, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Harvey. He's a National Defense Fellow at the University of Illinois in the Program for Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. He is an Air Force, active duty Air Force officer and command pilot. And we're talking here a little bit about how it is we're thinking these days about the defense that we need and how to get there. Questions are welcome. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. I think probably when people think about the possibility of restructuring, making major changes in the way the armed forces are structured in this country, people also talk about service rivalry between the various branches of service and wonder whether, in fact, we couldn't set up a system that was more unified rather than have separate branches that seem to compete with one another for resources and sometimes perhaps duplicate hardware and other things because, you know, if you got a plane, somebody else has got to have their own plane. And it can't be the same plane. It's got to be a different plane. And that really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And I'm sure, though, that within the various branches, there are very strong traditions, ideas that independence are a very important thing. And the idea is that, you know, we're the Air Force and we're the Army and we're somehow different. Can you imagine, though, moving toward a time when it's more like just one force and you don't really have that kind of separate identity?
Yes,
that is, we
can.
we have a sea-based. We have a sea-based leg, we have an air-based leg, we have a land-based leg, and that it's all really part of one force.
Exactly, and that's the driving force behind what's known as the Graham-Rudman Act in 1986. Prior to that time, even though we had a joint staff, it really didn't answer to the president. The chairman didn't work for the president, he worked for the Secretary of Defense. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff now works directly for the president. The Joint Chiefs of Staff is made up of the commanders of all the services. They sit on the staff on the joint in the tank and decide what's best for America overall as opposed to what's best for the individual services. So we are leaning in that direction. It's kind of a baby steps kind of thing. We have to go one step at a time. But now that the Joint Staff is developed and actually owns oversight, there's a division of the Joint Staff that talks about oversees acquisition of all the services. The services have to recommend to the Joint Staff, we want to buy this particular aircraft or this particular ship, and the Joint Staff has to recommend that to the Chairman. The Chairman recommends that to the President. So we're moving in that direction. It may take another few decades or even longer before we have a little bit more seamless operation. Currently, however, again, if you go back structure that Congress has given us, they have created five separate divisions for money: the Air Force, the Army, Navy, the Special Operations. Okay, four. The Marine Corps gets their money from the Navy. Mm-hmm. So the Special Operations Command is independent. So each is competing for a part of the budget that Congress will allow at the end of the year. So again, it's an all an interactive type of thing between the military budget or the military departments, the Secretary of Defense, and the Congress. Congress is actually the power of the purse. They're the ones who decide what we're going to buy and when we're going to buy it. Now, sometimes there are things that maybe are lower priorities for the military services to buy, but they're higher priorities for congressmen to buy because it's built in their district. Okay, so those are kinds of infighting that go on in Washington that you have to take into account when you're trying to budget things. Mm-hmm. It is a big budget battle. Eventually, hopefully, in the future sometime, that we'll all work for, well, we all do work for one guy, but we'll all the budget folks will work for one guy, and that'll solve some of those problems. When you look at the capabilities of each of the independent services, though, I think when you get down looking at the details of what each individual service does, you'll see that there's really not that much overlap. Even though, for example, the Navy has some space structure, they primarily channel most of that through the Air Force. So anything that really goes up into space, channeled through the Air Force, whether the Navy owns it or the Air Force owns it or NSA owns it, doesn't really matter. It's kind of channeled through Space Command. So we try not to duplicate effort. And another thing we try to do is use commonality and buy off-the-shelf type technologies. For example, the Joint Strike Fighter that we're trying to build, that will be a fighter for all the services. The Marines will buy it, the Navy will buy it, even the British Marines will buy it, and, of course, the Air Force will buy it. We're talking about a common airframe, and then it does different capabilities. It will land on a carrier, it will take off vertically or short takeoff for the Marines, yet a conventional takeoff version for the Air Force. So mm-hmm. We're trying to do that. We're working towards that. But that's an excellent point, and Graham Rudman are a few years ahead of you there.
Yeah. Well, one wonders if even I'm certain that in the future, no matter what happens, there would still be people would strongly identify with what it is they do, and there would be this really strong sense of identity, perhaps that I fly jets, mm-hmm. or that I'm a Marine, and, right. or that I'm a guy who works on an aircraft carrier or a battleship or whatever. But can you really even imagine a day when everybody's essentially wearing the same uniform?
I could see that. Personally, I like that idea that we're all just in the service of the United States, and we all wear the same uniform, and I just happen to fly, or I just happen to do this as my part of that contribution. Certainly, I think that there is a strong mentality toward that in the United States military. We're all Americans first, and we all try to think that way. Although, you know, when you ask me what I do, I say, well, I'm a pilot. You know, I'm an airman. Basically, I'm an airman. I do whatever the Air Force needs me to do. Same with Marines. Marines are Marines. They do whatever they're told to do, whether they're carrying a rifle or pushing a pen in Washington somewhere. We're all Americans first, and I hope we keep that attitude.
Yeah. Going back to the point that the caller raised, I think that, again, some people who are in the defense policy business or analysis business have been talking for some time now about how new technologies will revolutionize defense. And, for example, the one point that you discussed on uninhabited aircraft, airplanes essentially that have no pilots. Yeah, right. And there are a lot of other things that sometimes are in the category of whiz-bang stuff that, you know, one wonders, is this just a cool-sounding idea, or can this thing actually become something that we would use? But having said all that, I think, though, that some people are suggesting that we could be doing more already with taking advantage of new technologies, and that for some reason we're just very slow. And that is, it's hard to break out of the way that we had been thinking about what kind of conflict we were preparing for and how to meet that. And in fact, sometimes I think some people suggest that one of the problems we're having nowadays is that rather than the missions shrinking that we think that the military needs to perform, they have actually grown. We're actually expecting more of the military because we haven't quite gotten away from the old land-based war idea, and at the same time, we have added all these other things on, which
That's
means
a great
we need
point.
More rather than less.
That's a great point. I'd like to address that for a minute, if I could. The number of missions that we've been asked to do over the last 10 years has grown exponentially. Now, for example, I'd like to quote General Krulak, the Marine Commandant, former Marine Commandant. He coined a term called a three-block war. What we're asking this 18-year-old kid now with a rifle to do is some young corporal. We send him to a place, let's say, for example, Somalia. And in the first block, as he's walking into a village or a town, he's met by cheering crowds who are glad to see him, patting him on the back, treating him really nice. But when he gets to the second block, what he's found is the crowds aren't quite so enthusiastic yet. They're still crowds, but then from the rooftops, the snipers are shooting at him and his buddies. You're asking him to make the distinction in block one to block two between good guys, bad guys, when to shoot, not to shoot. And then he gets to block three, and the crowd becomes hostile. Now you're asking him to make the decision, good guys, bad guys, who to shoot, who not to shoot, civilians, not civilians, who's got weapons and whatnot. You're taking a kid off the street of America, just average kids like you've got here in the university, and you're giving him a rifle, you're giving him some training, but how can you really train a kid for that? How can you train him to understand the difference between block one, block two, and block three? That's quite a challenge, a significant challenge for a young man to deal with or a young woman to deal with. That's the challenge that we face today for the younger guys. Let's back up and talk about the technology issue, though, that the caller brought up. Mm-hmm. Technology is a wonderful thing, but remember, it's very expensive. So, again, we work within constrained budgets, and hopefully we're not out there wasting too much money. We're trying our best not to. But let's say, for example, in World War II, we wanted to blow up a factory in Schweinfurt, Germany. We sent 300 B-17s, 300 B-17s with 10 men each, so 3,000 men. We lost 60 in one day. We lost 600 men in one day. And we went back the next day and did the same thing, lost 60 more airplanes. Now, today, with our technology and our advancements, and remember, this is only 50 years, 55 years now, with our technology today and our advancements, we can blow up that factory with one airplane, one guy, two bombs. Okay, and we can put them in whatever window we want to put them in. Now, that's a great capability to have, but it sure doesn't help us in that three-block war. So we've been working on that for 50 years. We haven't been working on the three-block war up until this last decade. Now we're trying to train military folks or people who've been thinking this way for 50 years or one way for 50 years how to deal with a totally different problem. Yet that young corporal still has to be able to hit the beaches as in the folks in Iwo Jima did.
Yeah, I think that it's one specific thing that I know I have talked with people about, one technological development that makes a big difference is the ability we have to gather intelligence about the opponent, the field of battle. It certainly was the case for a long, long time, probably through most of the history of warfare, that you really don't have any idea what you're going to face till you get there. And once you're in a battle, when you're in the middle of it, it's really hard to know what's going on just a little bit to one side of the place that you are.
Exactly. Warfare is not an easy thing to deal with. It certainly doesn't follow any set rules. Intelligence gathering, though, can give you an incredible advantage over your enemy if you get the right intelligence. Remember, he's trying to give you false intelligence as well. He's trying to conceal whatever it is he's trying to do. He's trying to conceal that from you. Likewise, you're trying to conceal it from him. So intelligence would be a magnificent thing if you had all-powerful intelligence, all-seeing, all-knowing. That's what we're working toward. We've got all kinds of intelligence gathering techniques and mechanisms and tools, everything from satellites down to people and listening posts on the ground. But still, putting all that intelligence together and determining the course of action that your adversary is taking and then determining what course of action you should take to defeat his course of action, that still is a skill, an art, that that has to be developed and trained in the officers and the leaders.
Mm. Well, though, is it really the case that, say, if you're a commander in the battlefield, if I could give you now the kind of information that commanders who came before you never would have had, that is, say, I'll give you a perfect view of the terrain. I'll tell you where where your opponents are. I'll give you from minute to minute, you'll know exactly what's happening, where your guys are, where his guys are. Does that really, though, mean that then I can say to you, now, I'm going to give you all this information, but I'm going to also give you less hardware, fewer troops than I would have in the past, and that maybe you think you need? Can I actually do that?
Yes, you can. You certainly can. If I know what's going to happen, if I knew exactly what was going to happen, then I could tell you the exact minimum number of force structure that I would need to counter that. Mm. That would be great. But again, there's something called the fog of war that Carl Clausewitz developed back or brought up back in the 1800s, that things don't always go the way you want, and you just don't know what's going to happen. So you need to be prepared for the unknown, the unexpected.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Harvey, he's a National Defense Fellow at University of Illinois, in the Program for Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security. Questions are welcome, 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here's a caller to talk with in Champaign County on our line number one. Hello.
Good morning. It's not particularly a question, though. The deterioration of language that the military uses is widely commented on, and I think we've had a lot of examples of that. One thing I'll just point out is that the U.S. is just looking out at what the existing environment is as if it hasn't had a lot to do with constructing the realities it's having to deal with. And it sort of presumes that, you know, there's no discussion of policy other than military. This idea of the three-block war sort of really brings it right home that what we're talking about is a war against civilians, and that's why Kerry is in the position he's in, because it was a war against civilians. You slit the throats in one hutch, you line them up in another area and shoot them. There are different strategies for different blocks, but the main thing is that it's a war against civilians that is embodied in the premise of that whole discussion. I'm just going to talk right past this guy and say that I think it's interesting to see that the first caller, the only other caller actually, the presumption was that, you know, missile defense is just well on its way, and it's also not a policy that can be discussed. And I'm just curious that the announcement is coming today. That's curious also that they're now talking about sea-based in a big way, which I guess is because you have to get some of these Navy people and the shipyards involved in it too. But there's a book written by someone in the Syracuse peace community a long time ago, I hope it's still in print, called Arming the Heavens, which just sort of catalogs the kind of mad fancies that people were having at the beginning of the space age, what kind of weaponry and that sort of thing. He actually makes the argument that the space shuttle was upsized because it was also seen as a personnel delivery to hotspots kind of vehicle. Never really was. That's enough for me, I guess. I'll just hang up and listen to the rest of this, whatever one would call it.
All right. Well,
all right, thank you.
Can respond, and if you want to respond to some of the
questions. Sure, I'd like to take that one on. Well, first of all, let's just point out that the United States government makes the policy, and I agree with you. If you don't like the policy, you're certainly free to call your congressman, call your senator, and I encourage you to do that. The point is that the military does the best job that they can do given a situation such as Bosnia or Somalia or whatever it is. We do the best that we can do. We're just average Americans like everybody else out here trying to do the best job we can. The point that I would drive home here is that policy is made by the politicians, which in turn is made by the people. And the people of this country have a great, powerful tool in that they can email their congressman, call their congressman, write to their congressman, their senator, pick up the phone, give them a call. They'd love to hear from you.
Other questions are welcome. As I said, we have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. One of the things that we've talked about, one of the changes in the nature of the mission that military have to face is that there are now more missions where military are involved where it's not a clear-cut combat situation, where they're involved in peacekeeping, they're involved in essentially doing things that are intended to effect or support some kind of political change on the ground somewhere in the world that does not involve us bombing the place.
That's exactly right. Our new mission, if you'll call it that, is to do many other things besides just a clear-cut war, one side versus the other side. This concept of peacemaking or peacekeeping, for example, you put our troops in between two belligerents, or maybe even more belligerents, as is the case in Bosnia, and you kind of put our boys and girls in between the other folks that are shooting each other, and you say, please don't shoot at our guys in the middle. That's an interesting concept. It holds, and it's held in Bosnia because the belligerents have decided not to shoot at the peacekeeping forces. In other cases, that doesn't always work. Now, the concept of peacemaking is so close to the other end of the spectrum called warfare that you have to go into a situation and make the belligerents stop shooting at each other. That's a difficult thing to do, and that's more closer to warfare, and we kind of shy away from that. But again, you have to ask the public of America before you get involved in one of these kinds of things, is it worth it to American to have Americans getting killed? Is it worth it to America to have Americans getting killed as opposed to other people getting killed in another part of the world? And at what point do we say yes and at what point do we say no? Again, that's not up to the military to decide. We pretty much go where we're told to go and do the best that we can do. I just want to bring one other thing back here. That young corporal walking through the three blocks, he's just an average kid from America somewhere with an average education, hopefully better than average education, and he's trying to do the best that he can. You know, he's not out there to give anybody a black eye by doing something illegal, immoral, or any of those kinds of things. He's worried about his life and his buddies' lives, and he's just trying to do the best he can. Mm-hmm. We owe him the benefit of the doubt and try to support him a little bit.
Is it possible to say here, I'm asking you essentially to do something that's not really possible because you can't speak for everybody in uniform, but is it possible to say how people in military, particularly the people who really are on the ground, the people walking along carrying rifles, feel about the places that they go now where the mission is not that clear, where they have as much of a political function as a military?
Right. I can certainly speak to that. I've got many friends in all the services, and it involves the Air Force as well. Originally, in the early 90s, most people were kind of shocked and upset and said, why are we doing this? Why am I doing this? This isn't what I do. I fight wars, etc. But over the decade, we've adapted to it, and we've learned that's going to be our bread and butter. That's where we're going to make our money. So we've adapted to it. We've done the best that we can, and we're trying to make it work, and we're just in there pitching and trying to do the best that we can. I think it's not so much a sore point anymore as an understanding that if we're involved in these situations, hopefully we'll avoid the bigger wars at the far end. So we want to get involved. We want to do our best.
Hmm. What do you think about the kind of quality of recruits that you're getting now?
I think the quality of the military force structure is phenomenal today. The all-volunteer force, first of all, it's made up of people who want to be there. Certainly those that reenlist and stay in, made up entirely of people who want to be there. And I think America and Americans can all be proud of the force structure that we have today. These kids are phenomenal. They're bright, they're intelligent, they're nice, they're kind kids. They like to have fun, we all like to have fun, but push come to shove, I couldn't think of anybody else in the world I'd rather depend on than these American kids out there today.
Mm. As I said, we have a couple of minutes left. If someone has a question, let's get on the phone real quick. Don't wait until the last minute. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-WILL or 9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that's good wherever you can hear us. Around Illinois, Indiana, that's 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. I think we are getting another caller here lined up. So rather than, again, launching into a question, I will wait and we'll get them ready to go here on our line number one. And right here again, Champaign County. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I have a question for the Lieutenant Colonel.
Yes.
I have a 12-year-old son who has been interested in the Air Force since he was probably about 5 years old. And it sounds like your guest has had a good career in the Air Force. And I just wondered if he could give me an idea about his background and how he became interested in this type of career and what I might be able to do for my son if he continues to show this kind of interest.
Well, I've always been interested in flying. I've loved the idea of flying ever since I think I was 8 years old and saw the Thunderbirds fly at an air show. And that's the first thing I would tell you is take him to an air show and let him see all the airplanes because he'll love it. First thing that's going to be important is his education. I encourage all the kids out there to get an education. That's the most important thing. And all the officers, all the pilots in the military are officers. And all the officers have to have a four-year college degree before they are considered to be officers. So encourage his education, surely, and take him to air shows. Take him out to an airport and let him fly once so you can get an introductory flight at most of the little base operators at some of the local airports, and that will really help him out.
Okay, thanks so much.
You bet.
Okay, we'll try to get one more here. The caller is in Champaign. It's line two. Hello.
Hi, I just have an observation and a question. The two callers back, the gentleman's equating the Vietnam experience with what we were trying to do in Somalia and Bosnia is way off base, and his language was a little pejorative. I did agree with him, though, on the missile defense plan. I get the impression that we're much better off building our conventional infrastructure, and I'm not anywhere near convinced that this missile defense plan is feasible or that we should pursue it, and I was wondering if you could comment on that, and I'll hang up.
Okay, thanks. Sure, I'll give you my opinion on that. First of all, you know, that's NMD, National Missile Defense, a very expensive project. Whether or not we need that, I don't have made up in my own mind yet, but I do understand both sides of the issue that some folks think that there's potential out there for somebody to launch a nuclear weapon at us, at the United States. Should that ever happen, it would be a sad day if we didn't have a national missile defense. But on the other hand, it is very expensive, and that's one of those things where you have to say, could I spend the money better elsewhere? Again, that's one of those things where I'd encourage you to let your senator know, because these decisions are made certainly directly in Congress and in the administration. They want to hear from you. They want to know what you think. They want to know, especially if you think you could spend that money somewhere else, to let them know.
Well, we're at the point we're going to have to stop, with the promise, I'm sure, that a lot of the things that we've touched on this morning, including National Missile Defense, we'll come back and we'll do other programs on. Certainly that, I'm sure, in the future we'll be talking about, and other sorts of defense-related issues from other perspectives. So if you're not happy with this one, you just stay tuned and we'll try and get some other shows for you. In the meantime, we want to say thanks very much.
Thank you, David.
Our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Robert Harvey, he's National Defense Fellow at University of Illinois in the Program for Arms Control, Disarmament, and International Security.